Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. And in this hour, students who want a say when decisions are being made about their education, how authoritarian regimes are intimidating students and faculty who come to the U.S. to study and teach, a Berea College student who escaped the Taliban of Afghanistan and is now trying to help the women of her home country, and a conversation with Lexington's Youth Poet Laureate. First, there are charts, graphs, and data that tell us all about economic, social, and health dynamics in our counties, but what about a measurement of the intellectual health of your community? Measures of the reading rate in your district? What proportion of your local population goes to college, gets degrees, and how the most recent stats compare with 6 years ago and with maybe the state as a whole? All of that information and more is gathered in Groundswell Community Profiles, the work of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, headed by Bridget Blom, a regular contributing interviewer on Eastern Standard. And today, our guest. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Bridget.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
In the introduction, I talked about some of the key education measures that are featured in the profiles. What among those stands out for you?
Well, kindergarten readiness is always one that folks will go to. They want to know how their community is doing, getting little ones ready for success in school. It's also something that I think community members can get their head around, how they might help improve that indicator. But another one that often jumps off the page at folks is the extent to which teenagers are achieving proficiency in mathematics and then going on to graduate. So a lot of times we'll see lower levels of math proficiency, lower levels of college and career readiness, and then a very high graduation rate. And that's true at the state level. It's also true at the local level. And people will puzzle over that and ask questions about how that can be. Are we really graduating kids who are ready for their next steps? And the answer is certainly not. And so really understanding what it takes to be successful post-high school is one of the areas where we want folks to go next when they look at that profile.
What do the most recent statistics tell us about how we're doing compared to before and maybe during the pandemic, which did have such a heavy impact on learning?
That's right. So we're seeing slight increases post-pandemic, which is an excellent thing to see. Our school districts and our communities have really focused on helping students capture some of that learning loss. And so while we need to see much more, seeing even slight improvements is a really good thing. It's important to note, and I have to admit a downer, to say that we were seeing declines in Kentucky's education outcomes before the pandemic. So what we see today is not just pandemic related. We've needed to really bring communities to the table in support of our schools and districts and our families and students for some time now. And we've also needed to stabilize the policy environment so our schools and our educators can really focus on improving high quality teaching and learning environments.
Well, you've mentioned that the profiles can serve as a good place to start a conversation, a local conversation, a springboard, if you will. Can you give us any examples of how that has actually happened?
Yeah, sure. And we absolutely want folks to open up this 4-page profile. It's not a heavy lift. And have an aha. That aha might be, wow, I had no idea my community was doing so good in an area. Or they might find something that really makes them puzzle, like I mentioned about college and career readiness and the graduation rate. They might look at the socioeconomic indicators on the back, on the 4th page of the profile, and realize some of the struggle in their community that spills over into families and students and results in barriers to student success, and identify ways to work on those issues. So a couple of great examples. In Covington, there's an effort called Read Ready Cove, and that was an effort spearheaded by the mayor there, Joe Meyer, and it was something of a campaign promise as he was running for mayor that he was going to do something about early literacy. And so he took it upon himself in his elected role to champion an early literacy campaign that put tools into the hands of all families with youngsters so that they could get their kiddos off to a strong start as they went into kindergarten and then in the early elementary years. Another example from years ago, long before the profiles, but one I like to lift up, is out of Christian County, Hopkinsville, a mother who was connected with the Pritchard Committee and knew all the data about her community. And she realized many of her boys' peers on the football team were not meeting ACT benchmarks and didn't really have clear plans for post-high school. So she took it upon herself to set up before and after football tutoring for all the young men on the football team to help them reach those ACT benchmarks and to start to think about their plans post-high school. And so those are both examples of an individual being attracted to a certain area in education, identifying their sphere of influence and deciding there is something they can do to make a difference.
I know that you also provide a facilitator playbook.
Mm-hmm.
It's a guide to help parents or school leaders or anybody else start a community conversation about areas that need more focus. Tell us about that playbook.
Yes, a conversation guide or playbook that someone can download with their profile. And it just helps them through a series of questions to identify where your ahas are, what you might want to respond to as an individual or a group, what additional data you might want to gather as you're making decisions about what next. And then one of the things we'll be doing at the Pritchard Committee to help take the conversation even further in the coming months is designing toolboxes. So if someone's interested in improving those early childhood outcomes, they can come to our website and they can get information, the research, the data, the strategies that will help improve those outcomes. And they can also be connected with others across the state who are working in that area.
In the introduction, I mentioned that this information can complement data on health and economy, but actually the profiles do also touch on economic and health outcomes related to education. What's the connection between education and these broader issues like economic development or public health?
Absolutely. So we know we don't improve one thing without improving other things. And health, economics, and education are a primary example of that. If we're going to improve education outcomes, we also need communities thinking about what's happening in the economy locally. What are they doing to support families? What's the economic development approach? And also, what are the health indicators? And are there things that somebody might take on in the area of health to improve health outcomes? So all of these things are interrelated. I think really thinking through the lens of placed-based community mobilizing and folks in our communities with a sense of agency, a shared vision for the future, a commitment to improving our Commonwealth community by community is the way we're going to improve outcomes across the board, health, our economic well-being, and education. The Pritchard Committee's lane is absolutely education, and we're clearly situated in that space. But we understand the connection of the others and want to amplify and support work in those areas as well.
What would you say the profiles reveal about both the challenges and the opportunities for Kentucky's education system in the near future?
I think it's always an important part of the story to remind Kentuckians that we really have something to be proud of in Kentucky. And that is in the 1990s and the 2000s, year after year, we were improving outcomes in education. And so what that tells us is we can do these things. We were, quote unquote, thank goodness for Mississippi, nearly dead last in all indicators in the 1980s. And we pulled ourselves up to roughly the middle of the pack. So we can, in fact, make improvements when we come together, when we support strong systems, and when communities come together to respond to the unique needs of students and families locally. Unfortunately, then what jumps off the page is since 2015, we've been realizing declines in our outcomes for a variety of reasons. And so knowing that we have Kentuckians who led that charge for improvement should spur us all, the next generation, to action to make sure that that work was not in vain, and we, in fact, are going to get into the ring and roll up our sleeves and continue the march to the top tier of all states and know that we can, in fact, do that when we work together.
Let's say a listener would like to get involved somehow and do what they can to help make a positive difference in their local school system. What are some practical ways to do that, to step up and do your part?
Yeah, well, we think the first way is definitely getting a hold of this groundswell community profile and then identifying what are you really passionate about? Is it early learning? Is it third grade reading and math proficiency? What else might it be? And how can you start to support students and families by, one, drawing attention and being a positive force for improvement? So this is always about collaboration in community, collaboration with our schools, collaboration with community-based organizations and neighbors to make a difference. But know the data, identify your sphere of influence and your area of passion, and decide to take the next step. I would encourage folks, if they want to reach out to us at the Pritchard Committee and let us be a support to you. Let us connect you with others who are also working in the area that you might want to work in. And then let us be a partner to you in telling your story of progress, of success, of innovation, of trying something and finding out whether or not it works.
These profiles are for all 171 school districts across the state, each for the years 2018, 2021, 2022, and 2024. So very comprehensive. They're online at Pritchard Committee, one word, PritchardCommittee.org. Bridget Blom, President and CEO of the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence, thank you so much for this work and also for sharing your expertise in the interviews that you provide us here on Eastern Standard. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, Tom. It's my pleasure.
Together, Raima Dutt and Minal Nazir serve as the cross-organizational coordinators, research leads, and board co-presidents at the Kentucky Student Voice Team, KSVT for short. KSVT is an independent nonprofit that supports Kentucky youth as education research, policy, and storyteller partners. And together, their aim is to create more just and democratic schools in Kentucky. Raima is a senior at DuPont Manual High School in Louisville. Manuel is a senior at Kentucky Country Day, also in Louisville. And I asked them to fill us in on KSVT's most recent research report called Time to Talk. It's a qualitative study of Kentucky high school students' perspectives on diversity and representation in their classrooms. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Raima and Manuel.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
Minal, let's start with you, if we could. Tell us what Time to Talk is all about. What is the report?
So Time to Talk was the study we recently published in February, and basically it is a qualitative follow-up on a study we released in 2021 called Race to Learn. So in Race to Learn, we did a survey that reached 10,725 high schoolers in 114 of the 120 counties in Kentucky. And we asked students how the race and ethnicity school climate was at their school. And based off of that report, Time to Talk goes into one of the findings, specifically racial and ethnic exclusion. And we did focus groups with groups of students across Kentucky, asking them specific questions about their experience with racial and ethnic exclusion. So Time to Talk basically goes into the findings from those focus groups.
What did you discover in conducting the Time to Talk study? Any key takeaways that you can share with us?
Yeah, so we actually have a few findings we took out from that. What we found was that students are being taught a very superficial education on diverse history, and that was found time and time again in most of our focus areas. On top of that, we also saw that students recognize that there is a problem or a disconnect between an understanding of what diversity and interacting with people different from you looks like. So we had people saying that they wanted to learn, but they were afraid to or weren't given the outlets or resources to do so without feeling judged or uneducated. And then finally, a big takeaway we found was that the students of color, who we also included focus groups of, they were willing to be the change, and they saw that there was a lack of their voices in career fields or just in representation in general, and they were ready to be that voice when they go into their future prospective career field as well.
Okay, Raima, let's bring you into this. I know that Time to Talk is not the first study KSVT has led related to issues of racial diversity in school. as mentioned, it follows the more quantitative study, Race to Learn. And that study was, as mentioned again, based on something like 11,000 middle and high school students all across the state. Is that right? Is that number right? About 11,000?
Yeah, just around there.
Incredible. And they were sharing their experiences in navigating the issues of race and ethnicity in school. How did that study come about? What inspired that study in the first place?
Yeah, so in around fall of 2021, there were bills popping up in our state legislature that were restricting conversations about how to discuss the history and legacy of racism in schools. And these were bills that were introduced by legislators who were not people actively in the classroom, right? They were probably twice or triple our age as students who the bills would be affecting. And neither were they students of color, the real population that is affected with these anti-race bills, anti-critical race theory bills. And us as a team of high school students, these bills were really, really like upsetting towards us just because decisions were being made without us, without our perspective, and really without the minority perspective of students of color. So as a team, we came together and we decided that we wanted to get the student perspective in this conversation, especially students of color, to help better inform public discourse around the subject. So as a team, we started drafting our Race to Learn report. We drafted questions that we wanted to interview and ask students from all across the state, no matter their background, no matter their county. And we opened this window in right before winter break in 2021. And when it closed 2 weeks later, we had over 10,000 Kentucky students respond to the survey from 114 of Kentucky's 120 counties.
The Kentucky Student Voice team is pretty unusual locally and even nationally in the way you support students, not just as subjects of education research, but as active partners in helping to design and conduct that research. And we've heard KSVT describe this approach as a way to democratize education research. But what does that mean to you exactly, to democratize research?
For us, democratizing research means putting students at the center of research that is being done directly to them or that directly impacts them. And what that looks like is that students are the ones who are actually conducting and directing all the research that we do, and that goes out to students themselves.
Minnell, I think it's important that our listeners understand that although KSVT is predominantly youth-led, it's also described as intergenerationally sustained, meaning older people like me serve as partners for a lot of the work that you do, and that's most definitely true for your research. And though students lead your research initiatives, you've enlisted a number of adult experts to support your work over the years. And since many of us don't often see examples of students and adults working together this way as co-equals, can you describe for us what that looks like in the context of your work and your research?
I think this intergenerational partnership is confusing to many. And for us, we really want to make sure that adults and students are viewed as equals, meaning that just because you're over 18, you don't have superiority over someone who's under 18. So because of this, we always refer to everyone by first name. So no matter if you're 40 or you're 16, we're on a first name basis. And that kind of really destroys that preconceived notion that we have to please an adult. But also what this looks like in practice is that the adults are the support systems for our team, right? When there's teenagers conducting high-level research, a lot of us don't have any previous experience. So these adults on our team will give us their expertise in a way that guides us to lead this research. So, you know, we might have questions along the way. How do we eliminate bias? How do we get around these sorts of things? And our adult partners will give us tips from their expertise so we can alter the ways we're conducting these studies. So we have adults on basically every one of our sub-teams from storytelling, research, and policy. And they're very, very helpful because I think as teenagers doing this work, it can get really scary because sometimes you don't know if you're doing it correctly. But by having professionals in every one of those fields guide you along the way, reassure you that you're doing it right and your voice matters, it really uplifts the entire team.
each of you might want to answer this question. I know that you both serve as cross-organizational coordinators supporting other students who are doing research, but also lots of other work on policy issues and storytelling. And I hear that in all of this, you place a special emphasis on building a certain type of internal culture. How would you describe the culture or some of the unique values of KSVT that you're trying to cultivate, and why is it important to you?
I think that our culture is so important and unique because it really does change the way you think. Like, I can describe how when I first joined, it was kind of revolutionary, really, to hear the words that you are an expert in your educational experience. And really putting the power in the hands of students who are really kind of told in our schools that we don't have the power and we don't have the ability to create change. That's something for the adults or something that you can accomplish in your future, but not right now. And I think KSVT does a great job of recentering that and to reminding us that we can be the leaders of today and not just of tomorrow. And like how Raima described, I think that intergenerational aspect and the respect that we give to students, it sounds so basic to treat students like people and with respect that they deserve and like they are capable of doing things. But it is something that we don't often see in our schools, and it's not a basic right that every student has the opportunity to have. And I think that is what we try to instill in our team, and also just remind them the work they are doing is so incredibly impactful. But it can also be taxing. We remind them to keep it light because at the end of the day, we are like still students and like teenagers in high school. And it doesn't always have to be done at the same standard and capacity that adults are doing it. So we try to bring elements of our own touch into that, like whether that's keeping our meetings very informal or like a lack of a hierarchical structure in our organization, like it's supposed to be very equitable in that nature and just accessible for everyone.
Yes, you are still students and teenagers, but I think our listeners would be pretty astonished to hear what all you do. I understand that you both serve in a number of other major leadership roles in the larger community. Raima, I know that you serve as chair of the Kentucky Education Commissioner's Student Advisory Board, correct?
Correct.
And Minnell, you are on the board of the Louisville Youth Philanthropy Association, and that's in addition to roles that you both play related to the Muhammad Ali Center's Youth Advisory Board and the Kentucky YMCA's Youth Assembly, among others. So we hear so much hand-wringing these days over youth voter rates, and yet you both seem so deeply civically engaged, which is a great thing to hear. What does your interest in community work say about you, and what, if anything, might it suggest about Kentucky youth more broadly?
To start, I think for both of us and also the rest of the Kentucky community who's doing work like this, it really shows that our position as non-eligible voters doesn't restrict our ability to create change within our communities and to get civically engaged, because we are the next generation of voters. Although I'm 17 years old right now, there's still ways to get involved in the community, look at the problems, look at the ways we as a society can help fix it. And by grouping together and really supporting these youth-led causes, I think teenagers are more excited than ever to get out there voting because they know that these issues affect them. They affect communities. And really, by being a part of these amazing groups that support youth voice is what helps amplify our voice and the next generation.
Yeah, and I'll also add on that point that I think a lot of times people forget how much work is being done in Kentucky already by youth. Like Raima and I will both attest that we feel so connected to the youth who are civically engaged in our state, even as big as it is, because we run into each other and you run in circles where everyone is kind of supporting one another. And there's a huge community for that.
Raima first and then Minnell, if you would follow up. What's in the future for you? What are your plans?
I'm still deciding between colleges, but I do plan on majoring in public policy. The work that I've done throughout high school has been so important to me, working directly with how state legislator and bills affect students and the youth. And for me, I see a really big future working within education policy. So That's my future goal for right now as a high school senior.
How about you, Minal?
Like Rima, I'm still deciding between colleges, so I don't know specifically where I'll be going, but I'm also going to be majoring in public policy. As for past college, I plan to attend law school, and I hope to do something around civil rights attorney, law, or something in that field in the future. I think education policy is like also something I might look into, and then hopefully going into nonprofit law or work further on.
Well, I have to say, after this conversation, I feel quite a bit more reassured about the future. Thank you both for your hard work. That's Rima Dutt and Minal Nazir. They serve as the cross-organizational coordinators, research leads, and board co-presidents at the Kentucky Student Voice Team. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Coming up after the break, escaping the Taliban, landing in Kentucky.
As a human, as a youth, as a young woman, I cannot tolerate this anymore.
Plus, silencing international students on American campuses and Lexington's new youth poet laureate. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
This is WEKU Arts reporter Sherry Lawson with coming events and artist opportunities provided by the Kentucky Arts Council. Winchester's Lead Center for the Arts will present a stage adaptation of Alexandre Dumas's The Three Musketeers, May 3rd through 5th and 10th through 12th. For more information and to purchase tickets, visit leadscenter.org. The Appalachian Artisan Center in Hindman holds its free art and action classes 5 to 6:30 p.m. every Thursday at the center. The program is for children ages 6 and up and includes kids' crafts, fine art, and an open clay studio. For more information, visit artisancenter.net/workshops. And join the Kentucky Arts Council in celebration of Kentucky Writers Day, April 24th at the Thomas D. Clark Center for Kentucky History in Frankfort. For more information, visit artscouncil.ky.gov. I'm Sherry Lawson. Now back to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Freedom House, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that works to inform us about threats to freedom, recently released a report about foreign governments silencing international students and educators who are on campuses here in the U.S. With seven campuses within our coverage area, EKU, UK, Transylvania, Georgetown Center, Kentucky State University, and the University of Pikeville, we invited Jana Garofowska, the report's co-author and research director for strategy and design at Freedom House, to tell us more about this report. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Jana.
Thanks for having me.
First, a broad definition. What is transnational repression? What's it look like?
So transnational repression is a term that we use, and it covers both physical and digital tactics that governments use in order to reach across borders to silence or intimidate or even harm dissidents, exiles, international students, and others who they may be targeting.
And what countries out there seem to be most engaged in this kind of behavior?
Yeah, so our data actually shows that 44 governments around the world use some tactic of transnational repression. And really the leading countries, the biggest perpetrators are China, Russia, the Central Asian countries like Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, but also Iran, Egypt, Rwanda. So it's a wide set of countries.
So what's going on? What kind of tactics are being used?
Yeah. So in the kind of physical sphere, these are everything from assassinations. So you may think of the murder of Jamal Khashoggi that happened a few years ago. There's also detentions, renditions. So when you're just kidnapped from a different country and brought back home, assaults. And then in the non-physical sphere, we see things like spyware, we see surveillance, we see intimidation of family members. So it's a lot of different ways to try and silence people.
Are there actual cases, instances of this that have happened on U.S. campuses?
There have been, unfortunately, quite a few that have popped up recently. There was a Chinese national who was just convicted. He harassed another Chinese international student after she participated in pro-democracy protests. That was in Boston. We saw in Georgetown and a few other universities in DC last year, if you remember, when the white paper protests were happening in China, there were similar protests happening at US campuses. And people who participated in those protests were sometimes assaulted, but most often what happened was that their families in China were visited by the police.
What about the university administrations? Are they aware that this is happening? Do they respond to it?
Well, there's very few responses, to be honest. Universities don't really know what to do with this. So if a student, this case in Boston that happened, the student actually came and complained to her institution, and they didn't really have much of a response. Mm-hmm. Very few universities understand that their students can be targeted in this way. And I should also say it's not just students. You know, visiting fellows, even faculty can be targeted in this way. So universities are kind of at a loss what to do about this. And often they may be influenced by other things like funding from foreign governments or, you know, in some cases, sort of a fear of seeming like they're promoting anti-Asian hate or something like that. So mm-hmm.
Now, I know that you've laid out a plan or some suggestions that administrators could follow to at least prevent this. Talk to us about those.
Yeah. So at the very kind of top, there should be a definition and understanding of what transnational repression is and the way it looks on campuses. And so I've talked a little bit about what can happen at protests or demonstrations, but also in the classroom. We know that surveillance happens when sort of sensitive topics are being discussed. So people should be aware of that. So establishing a definition and really understanding what transnational repression looks like on campuses is the first step. And then providing students and faculty and other affected members of the community with a way to report what's happening to them. So they need a reporting mechanism basically on campus. And it could look like some of the reporting mechanisms for sexual assault that exist on campuses. And finally, a set of procedures to know that, you know, what's the next thing that happens after you report being targeted.
You mentioned surveillance in the classroom. How does that happen? What goes on?
It can happen in a couple of different ways. So one is that basically if you're having classes on Zoom or something like that, those can be Zoom bombed or they can be monitored. Online discussions can be monitored. But also, unfortunately, it can happen that fellow students from the same diaspora can be asked to report back. We know of cases where some students have been asked by embassy officials to report back on conversations in classrooms and the activity of their fellow students.
How common is this on American campuses? Have you seen any kind of an increase lately? It's a very tense world out there now.
It's really hard to say how common it is, in part because it's actually really effective. So students and faculty are afraid. I've worked on human rights issues for a long time. This is one of the few reports where I have had a majority of sources want to be anonymous. So people don't want to talk about this because a lot of them are endangering their families by doing so. So we don't have hard numbers. We know that this is really a problem. We have, you know, I've presented this work at universities, and I always have people come up to me afterwards and talk about how they've experienced this. So our impression is that it's widespread, but it's also effectively having a silencing, kind of a chilling effect on students and faculty. And so it's hard to count.
Tatiana Gorohovska, Research Director for Strategy and Design at Freedom House and co-author of a report on how authoritarian governments are intimidating international students, visiting scholars and faculty on American campuses. Thanks for your report, and thank you, Yana.
Thanks for having me.
There's a reason why Afghanistan is dead last among 143 countries ranked in a UN study for the happiness of its people. And it's the reason that Lamar Zala-Gran finds herself a student at Berea College in far distant Kentucky. Lamar grew up in Kabul in the years after the Taliban regime had been removed from power by an international coalition led by the U.S. She could go to college. She could dress and socialize as she pleased. She did not own a burqa. But when U.S. forces withdrew from Afghanistan 3 years ago, the country descended into chaos, and with the Taliban back in control, to a return to the brutal, soul-killing treatment of women. Lamar escaped, and she joins us to share that journey. Welcome to Eastern Standard, Lamar.
Thank you so much.
I'm very, very curious about your story. How did you find your way to the United States and particularly to Berea, Kentucky?
In 2022, I decided to escape from Afghanistan because I lived under the Taliban for a year in Afghanistan. And I received my scholarship from the country of Qatar because at that time I was studying at the American University of Afghanistan. So I received my visa from the country of Qatar. Basically, escaping from Afghanistan wasn't easy because for women in Afghanistan, there is restriction of movements. Women cannot move or travel. Women cannot walk even a mile without a male guardian. So a male guardian can be a husband, a father, an uncle, or a brother. When I received my visa from the country of Qatar to escape from Afghanistan, I got my flight tickets from American University of Afghanistan, but then they told me to go to the airport. When I arrived in the airport, all the procedures were done, exit visa, enter visa. Together with my ET classmate, they actually stopped us to fly from the Kabul airport to the international airport of Doha. Well, after 7 hours of negotiation between Qatari representative and the Taliban, they didn't allow us, the American University of Afghanistan students, female students, to fly from Afghanistan to the country of Qatar. But then they sent us back to home. They gave us back our bags, our luggage, and they even locked our passports and visa. And after 1 month, I decided to travel alone from Afghanistan to the Pakistan border. It was around 1 a.m. or 2 a.m. I started my trip together with my father. Basically, I convinced the Taliban on the other side of the border. He's my family members who's picking me up. After I successfully convinced them, I passed the border. When I passed the border, it was around like 4 or 3 hours trip from Pakistan border to the Islamabad capital of Pakistan. After 2 days, I got my flight tickets and I flew to Qatar. I stayed in Qatar for around 1 year. After that, I received a scholarship from Berea College, and then I got my visa, and I traveled from the country of Qatar to Berea College in Berea and Kentucky.
Wow, I have so many questions, Lamar. First, just a practical matter, getting from Kabul to Pakistan, how did you do that? Did you travel by car?
I traveled with car. And there was my father with me. And basically, my father convinced him that on the other side of the border, there's my son who's going to pick my daughter.
And what was your age at the time?
My age at that time, it was around 18 or 19.
Oh, boy. Well, I'm wondering what it must have been like for you, having lived most of your life free of the Taliban, to have that kind of rule return all of a sudden. It must have been quite a shock.
It was a complete shock for every single girl in Afghanistan. I couldn't even sleep for a week when I heard that Taliban is over there. All those good memories that I had before the Taliban occupation, it hurted, it bothered me a lot. I had all the freedoms. We had freedom of appearance, freedom of education, freedom of opportunities. We were involved in all these like civil rights activities as a woman. We were wearing Western dresses, jeans, makeup, and we were wearing scarf as well with all these jeans, makeup, and dresses. Because I was involved in the American University of Afghanistan, I need to remind the audience here that it was one of the top universities of Afghanistan. Every young generation dream was to get there, to get enrolled or to get the admission in this top college of Afghanistan. So the first days we have lost that I have lost that education opportunity because after the Taliban come into power, they closed our university. And after that, when the Taliban come into the power, on that time, I didn't have any burqa or hijab. And I didn't know what to do. So I borrowed a burqa from one of my friends or abaya just to be safe in the country. Because if you want to be safe in the country, we need to follow all the restrictions and rules that they provided for us. And every day we heard a new decree, a new anti-woman policy coming from the Taliban members. They ultimately force us to disappear from the society. And they still do that on the woman. There has been 1,000 days that girls are deprived of education. Girls cannot go to the colleges and university. When the Taliban came into the power, I had no dreams. I lost all my dreams. I lost all my hopes. My dreams got shattered. I had the dream of becoming involved in the politics, go and continue my education, get my bachelor's degree, get my master's degree. I didn't have any hope for the future, because when they come into the power, there was new things happening in the country. I hear the stories of the 90s from my mother, where my mother always described how Taliban were treating them, how they tortured them in public, how they have beaten them in the public, from my family members, how they went to the secret schools. I have been hearing from those post-Taliban stories of girls who went to the secret schools. And now the same thing is happening. The 90s are repeating. The Taliban are the same, the Taliban. They haven't changed so far. It's the same Taliban. It was a complete surprise for me, because I cannot be uneducated anymore. And it's the same thing for every Afghan woman now.
Well, how are you working now from here in Kentucky to pressure the Taliban to restore the rights of Afghan women? And do you think that's even possible with the Taliban?
Well, it's possible. If we keep silent, then the people who over there, they would continue to suffering. And I, as a human, as a youth, as a young woman, I cannot tolerate this anymore. Yes, of course, I come from Afghanistan now. I'm in the U.S. I have many opportunities for me, education, freedom of speech, opinion and expression, and all these opportunities. But still, when I have all these opportunities, my thoughts, my feelings, everything is with my little sister who is still in Afghanistan. Still, I'm running my nonprofit. I provide education and online classes for Afghan women over there. We provide them English classes, math classes, classes related to the new technology. We provide them workshop on variety of topics on graphic designing, capacity building, leadership skills, CV writing, email writing. And we even do our efforts to provide some of the conferences for them together with other organizations, so that every young woman in the country would benefit from all these education resources and opportunities that we are providing them from here, from the United States. Few months ago, I provided them a scholarship workshop, which I explained how to apply for the scholarship, how to get ready for the TOEFL score, how to fill out the applications here in the top colleges of the United States. I'm still doing my best to pressure on the Taliban to change their policies. I go to the events, I speak on social media, I use from my Instagram platform, LinkedIn platform, and Twitter platform to share from the my own personal experience. And every day when I speak with Afghan women over there, they tell me how they are suffering like every day, how they are living under the Taliban with no resources, with no freedom, with no freedom of opinion, expression, and all these stuff. And even there was a student last time, she called me, she told me that there's even like forced marriages are happening on them now, because sometimes the Taliban members force them to marry them. Or now at this extreme situation, most of the families of girls, they're having some financial circumstances. One day she texted me from one of my students, she said that now her family trying to sell her because they don't have a good economic situation. So this is happening in the country. And for us, for those people who come to the abroad, they need to speak for those people. Every day they're living under this oppressive regime, and they have no rights. They have no voice. If they raise their voice, they're being tortured. They're being arrested by the Taliban members. They're being even killed.
Well, let me ask you, Lamar, now that you're in the United States and we're in a very unusual election season right now, where there is talk of authoritarian or autocratic rule in this country, how does that strike you? What do you want people in America, in Kentucky, to know about democracy and rule of law?
So I wouldn't say it's a complete, like, there's no democracy or rule of law in Afghanistan now, like United States, to protect every citizen, to protect their values, their interests. They don't even think of our interests, because if you come to the Western, or if you come to the human rights or women's rights or the rule of law or the due process, if we discuss about this issue with them, they will tell us that you are not here to protect the interest of the citizen. We are here to protect the interest of Sharia law, which somehow they don't even follow the Sharia law. They don't even follow the religion, because in the religion it says that everyone in the country, they need to have the right of education and all these types of resources, and the government should provide all these resources and welfare life for the citizen. But they don't even follow like religion or Sharia law. So nowadays, they don't work for our interest. They work for their own interest. Their own interest is to enjoy from oppressing people.
Lamar Zalagran, a new international student at Berea College, where she's arrived from Afghanistan. We appreciate your time, Lamar. Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
It's year two of Lexington's participation in the National Youth Poet Laureate Program, sponsored locally by the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning. Here's Tom Eblin.
This year's Lexington Youth Poet Laureate is Zoya Abbas, a senior at Lafayette High School. Two award-winning local poets selected her from among five finalists for the role. Zoya is a student in the Literary Arts Program at Lafayette School for the Creative and Performing Arts. She also is a graduate of the Governor's School for the Arts. Zoya, welcome to Eastern Standard.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us a little about yourself and your family.
Yes, so I was actually born in India, and I am the only child of two parents. And growing up, I got to travel a lot, and I was really exposed to the arts quite a lot. It's a very important part of my family and my culture. And then when I was 12, I moved to the United States, and that's when I first, you know, heard about SCAPA. I started exploring my writing, making it like a professional gig. So that's kind of how I began.
What's it like so far being Youth Poet Laureate? You've been doing this a few weeks now.
It's been very overwhelming. It's been just such an incredible opportunity. The people I've gotten to meet, just the exposure that I've had, that's been something that I've always wanted to do with my arts that I never really had the opportunity to do before I moved here. So it's just, yeah, if I had to describe it in one word, overwhelming, but I'm very grateful for it.
Well, what do you hope to do in terms of your plans as Youth Poet Laureate?
Yeah, so one of my biggest goals as far as being Youth Poet Laureate is making, obviously, a difference in my community. And for that, I really want to bring the arts and these arts programs to schools that don't always get the attention that they need from like programs like SCAPA and other gifted and talented programs. Bringing the arts to middle schools, elementary schools, that's my biggest goal, making it more approachable, because I know, especially with poetry, it can be a little intimidating for people. They may think it's a little pretentious, which I understand. But yeah, my biggest goal is to make art approachable, make poetry approachable for people.
Mm-hmm. Well, when did you start writing poetry?
I wrote my first poem when I was 4. It was a dream I had, and I wrote it down in a poem at like 9 o'clock in the night. And the next day I told my parents, oh my gosh, I'm a poet now. I wrote a poem. So that was my first exposure to the arts. And after that, when I was 7, I started creating a blog where I would put all my poetry and my writing. And that was the beginning of that journey.
Mm-hmm. What is it about poetry that poetry especially that excites you?
I think the biggest thing about poetry for me is that it's not restrictive. I mean, there are, of course, like forms you can have, structures. But for me, free verse poetry has always been so freeing. I can just put my thoughts into words and put it down on a page, and there's no restrictions to it. So that's the most gratifying feeling about doing poetry, is that there's no one telling you, oh, you have to write these many lines or you have to have these many characters. It's just do whatever you want and put it down into words.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the topics you write about?
I'm very self-centered. I write about myself quite a lot. The experiences I have, the people I've met, that's my biggest inspiration. One of my biggest inspiration comes from my family, all the people in it. One of my favorite poems I've ever written has been about my grandmother. So just, yeah, I like to talk about what's going on in my head and what I think of the world around me.
Mm-hmm. Who are some poets that you admire?
My biggest inspiration in poetry is Amanda Gorman, not in terms of just the writing she does, but just the impact she's had on the world, on the United States. She's really brought poetry to the youth. I think after her inauguration poem, I think that's when I first saw people talking about poetry who weren't within my community of writers. So she's my biggest inspiration.
Mm-hmm. Any others you'd like to mention?
Yeah, I think another one is Bengali. That's I'm Bengali. That's the part of India I'm from. So one of the Bengali poets, Rabindranath Tagore, he's, I mean, one of the most famous writers in India itself. So I think he's my biggest inspiration too.
Mm-hmm. You have college plans for next year?
Yes, I will be heading to American University up in Washington, D.C. I want to pursue political science and go into law.
How do you think poetry might fit into your future as a political scientist or a lawyer?
I think writing is always going to be a part of my life, whether I do it in law, whether I do it for fun. I think poetry is always going to keep me grounded. It's going to remind me that no matter what I do, the people I meet or the experiences I have at the heart of it, I'm always going to be a poet. And it's always going to remind me of who I am at the core.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know a lot of poets who earn a living that way, so that's probably a good move. Well, do you have anything you'd like to read for us today?
Yes, of course. So, like I mentioned, a lot of my poems are about the people in my life, and one of my favorite poems was a persona poem that I wrote from the persona of my grandmother, and it's called Amma. Baba High Court Judge Chilin, Amader Patna Bari Khub Shundor Chilo. I wish you could have seen it, Roshu, our sprawling bungalow in Patna, filled with vines, wild mango trees and dogs, Judy the greyhound, Wendy the dachshund, Ma's pet deer before it became illegal to own one. She kept a garden in the back where she grew vegetables. Of course, she was never the one who cooked them. There were multiple secret passageways for a little girl to get lost in. The rain in the monsoon seasons would pitter-patter against my window frame. The humidity would cause my hair to frizz. Oh, if only you'd seen it, Roshu. Baba commanded high respect. His people loved him. He stood up for the low-wage workers, argued for the little guy. I hope you do the same too, Roshu. The house was full of magic and music and light and colors. I wish you could have seen it, Roshu, before everything, before the demolition, the court cases, the family against family. I wish you could have seen it, Roshu. I know you would have loved it.
That's very nice.
Thank you.
Well, what advice do you have for other young people who might be interested, whether it's in poetry or other types of creative writing or expression of?
I think one of the biggest misconceptions people have is that it's the same as what you write in your English classes. They can get intimidated by that. And I think to them, I'd say it's writing is everything you make of it. There's no one to tell you what you should do, what you should be writing about. Just I think the biggest thing I could tell them is just do it. Just sit down and whenever you have an idea, just write it down. Even if it's in the middle of the most inconvenient times, I mean, just have it written down somewhere, go back, look into it. I think the biggest thing that stops a lot of people, especially in writing stumps, is that they get too much in their heads and they think, oh my gosh, this is not the right thing to say. What am I saying? Why am I doing this? Just do it. I mean, there's no one to tell you what to do. That's why I love poetry so much. There's no restrictions.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any plans for publishing yet? Or
Yes. I mean, one of my biggest goals is to publish my own book of poetry. I have a few on my blog. So I think getting all of those together into like a cohesive chapbook would be a really big goal of mine. And yeah, I think the Youth Poet Laureate program will really help me with that. So that's my goal for the next upcoming few years.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you.
And I've been speaking with Zoya Abbas, a senior at Lafayette High School and at Lexington's second Youth Poet Laureate. Zoya, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
For the Carnegie Center for Literacy and Learning, this is Tom Eblin reporting for Eastern Standard.
Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. We're online at esweku.org, where you can check out the Eastern Standard archive, our series, our partners, and more, and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.